On today's UFO Files, we're turning the hands of time back to the 1950s.
We interrupt this record to bring you a special bulletin. The reports of a flying saucer hovering over the city have been confirmed. The flying saucers are real.
The 1950s is an interesting time, innocent times in many ways, but really when it came to UFOs and flying saucers, hey, it was no secret. They were everywhere.
But this is John Cameron, Cameron again. I believe the spaceman has a final parting word.
See you later, alligator.
We return you now to our studio.
The spacemen have gone again, but look to the skies. The saucers will always be there.
Always be there.
That was Buchanan and Goodman with a popular hit in the 50s, a takeoff on flying saucers and extraterrestrials and contact from outer space. Since we're going to be out in Landers, California, in the high desert of Southern California on April 29th all day on Saturday, helping MC the first annual Retro UFO Spacecraft Convention, I thought it'd be fun to get a hold of Colin Bennett. He's in London, England. And Colin wrote a book about a fellow by the name of George Adamski. He wrote a biography. And Adamski was quite popular during this period. Now, he really wasn't out there at the Integridon, but he was in Southern California, and he was claiming contact. In fact, he had a best-selling book called Flying Saucers Have Landed. And Colin, we invited you to come on the show to talk to us about George Adamski. I notice he has a co-author here, Desmond Leslie. Who exactly was that?
Desmond Leslie didn't meet Adamski at first. The publisher...
It was arranged.
Yeah, arranged.
In other words, Adamski wasn't capable of writing the book, the publisher didn't think.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You wouldn't expect him to. Oh, no, no, no. He wasn't a fully educated man at all. But Desmond Leslie was, and he wrote these scholarly, historical part, research part of the book. About UFOs in history and their attachment to all kinds of occult inspirations, etc. And it's a brilliant essay. It forms the first part of Flying Saucers of Landed. And then the publisher had the brilliant idea of, well, let's meet a guy who's actually says that he's seen a flying saucer. Not in Egypt, not in Jerusalem all those years ago, but last year. And they brought the two together. So you read Desmond Leslie, you've got history, and then suddenly you turn the page, and there's George Adamski saying, "I have met a being from a flying saucer, such as the ones Desmond Leslie is describing in history." It was a magnificent, brilliant policy route, and the book took off.
And the book Flying Saucers Have Landed was one of the first pioneer books.
Yes, oh, indeed, yes, one of the very first.
And Adamski's creature from outer space was more or less humanoid.
Yeah. It was a tall, slim...
Yeah, I always assumed he was somewhat like the entity that landed in the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still.
No. This is a handsome young man.
Okay.
With long blonde hair and a kind of ski suit.
Okay, so he was godlike.
He was godlike, yeah. In this sense, he was rather like you know the youth at the end of Thomas Mann's novel Death in Venice.
You've stated before that Charles Fort was the first ufologist.
Yes, he was.
How much of influence do you think Fort had on Adamski?
Well, he certainly had an influence on Desmond Leslie. There's quite a definite influence from Charles Fort, who died in 1933. And his book of the damned on Desmond Leslie. He couldn't have written the first part of the Flying Saucers Have Landed without being influenced by Charles Fort.
And during this time, to give a little background for people to flesh this out, you had these groups of followers that the media were referring to as crazed UFO followers that would go out in the desert or go up to Mount Palomar where Adamski was. And they'd hold court, and they'd talk about these things, right?
Yes.
They'd talk about the higher meaning of it all.
Yes, yes. The metaphysical interpretation of such experiences. And as I say, he was of a very great influence in seeing religion and seeing mystical experience in a new context.
And as far as you know, Adamski really never got involved with the people out in the desert like Van Tassel and that group.
I don't think he had...
And the giant rock and all that.
Yeah, I think they... excuse me. I think they knew of one another. I have no evidence that George Adamski met Van Tassel, no.
But this whole movement, so to speak, was actually picking up in Southern California.
Yes.
And they were going out in the desert and meeting these people.
Yes.
The creatures.
Yes.
And having contact.
Yes. These are superior beings from another dimension or another planet or some other kind of reality. And they're superior to us in their moral life.
Now Adamski was quite... up there in years, probably by this time, if he served in World War II. I mean, World War I.
Yes, oh yes, he was nearly 70, yes.
Yeah, and so, and he was there at the foot of Mount Palomar, and he had this hamburger stand.
That's right. He was a charismatic character, wasn't he, George Adamski? Everybody liked him, and he had wonderful features. Though he was a Pole, he had something of a North American Indian in his features. There were lined features, the features of a kind of tribal guru.
He was quite striking, in other words.
He was quite striking. And he appealed to me. He gave out healing sessions, and he was quite successful. He gave people great solace. We're not talking about whether we believe this or not. The fact is that Adamski and people like him, you know, they did give healing. They did give them... they did good things to people.
In other words, there was no horror stories involved with these contacts. It was all feel good, be good type things.
No, the kind of thing they're surrounded with today. No.
Mm-hmm. When you wrote this book, had to do a lot of research. Anything amazed you about the 50s in the States about their ability to believe in?
Oh yeah. One of the great mysteries started here. You know, if you take a man like Adamski and you don't believe in any of these things, the military, who said they didn't believe in any of these things, took an extraordinarily deep interest in George Adamski right from the beginning. Yeah, he was under surveillance in these innocent days. Yeah, long before Vietnam, long before Watergate.
I always assumed, and maybe you have an opinion about this, that he was under surveillance, like many of these UFO groups in the 50s,
yes,
because the government really didn't know too much about it themselves.
They didn't. They didn't. They were very much afraid. Well, I suppose if you're a really open-minded, first-class mind in intelligence, if there's creatures from other planets flying...
Well, I mean, you'd had several incidents already, Roswell, Aztec, other UFO crashes in the desert.
Yes.
Sightings over Washington, D.C. in 1952 were phenomenal.
Yes.
You would understand why they would be, and as you know, you've been involved in investigations for a long time.
Yes.
Governments, not only in America, but England and wherever. You can be sitting at a desk, and the guy next to you, you might think he's working on something, but it would be totally opposite.
Yes, this is Ruppelt's experience when he first joined the Air Technical Intelligence Team at Wright-Patterson Air Force.
Yeah, now he wrote that book when he got out of the Air Force, and was actually a direct opposite of Adamski, but had a meeting of the minds there at the hamburger stand.
Yes, yes, and those magical moments... When originally in the desert experience in 52, this creature went back into the UFO, and he left footprints in the sand, and the UFO took off. George Hunt Williamson, who was with Adamski as a witness, quite a well-known writer on esoteric subjects, went to the site where George had seen this thing, a few hundred yards away, and took plaster casts of the impressions in the sand. that, by the way, let's call the being Orthon, because he was called Orthon by Adamski's editor.
So he had a name.
He had a name, yeah, which is absurd, really, because he was an editor's invention. But you had to call him something.
So he took these footprints. Did he make plaster prints on?
Exactly, yeah.
Are they around today?
Yeah, well, there's a bit of a mystery there. When Ruppelt, after he left the Air Force, toiled up the slopes of Mount Palomar to see George and eat his burger and coffee bar, he didn't identify himself. He didn't introduce himself to him.
Right, he just walked in and ordered a hamburger and a beer.
That's right, yeah. Because the Project Blue Block he was on was a secret project at the time, etc. And if Adamski had known that he was an Air Force intelligence officer, he's a kind of person.
I think one thing we need to really stress here, in the early 50s, when we're talking about 52 and 53, there was a lot of news coverage about Project Blue Book, about UFO sightings over Washington, about possible jet fighters crashing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right, yes. And, well, as Ruppelt sat there...
So it was a hot topic in the media. It was a hot topic.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so he went out over there, and he was sitting there having a hamburger and a beer, and Adamski didn't know.
An amazing thing happened. As Ruppelt describes it in his book, Adamski, after he served a few beers, got requests from people in the restaurant to show them Orthon's, the plaster casts from Orthon's feet. And in a magical moment, Ruppelt leaned forward, Adamski went behind the bar, produced a shoebox, and there were the plaster casts of Orthon's feet.
So he had the plaster of Paris footprint right there at the bar.
Yes, in a magical moment, yes, the combination of the most surreal and bizarre circumstances of an unbeliever seeing something which is almost unbelievable. There's great drama in the UFO story. It's a human story as well as a story of the most fantastic events.
So they're sitting there probably drinking Mexican beer, Corona beer.
Yeah.
Feeling no pain by then. And bring out the footprint. Did that change Rupert's mind?
No, he didn't. It did not.
Okay, Ruppelt, I guess, is the actual way he pronounces his name.
Well, he was a very confused man at the end. Ruppelt was very confused, and this may have added to the confusion.
It just added to the mystery.
Yeah, indeed.
We really look forward to the new version of the book on Adamski coming out later in the year.
To this year, there'll be a new edition.
When we come back, Colin, I want to talk to you about your latest endeavor.
Yes, fine.
So don't go away.
Step into a modern-day time machine and revisit the UFO phenomena of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Saturday, April 29th, it all comes together in the high desert of Southern California, the Retro UFO Spaceship Convention at the world-famous Integratron. Tours of the giant rock and the Integratron, plus lots of other great events, including a speaker lineup of UFO researchers who will unveil many amazing facts about this time period and the reported visits to Earth by the space people. View a video of the original spacecraft conventions. Food, fun, vendor areas, art exhibits, car club exhibitions, space rocks, live bands, and much, much more. Hurry, space is limited. So make your reservations now. Click on the banner on this page, and we'll see you at the Space Convention.
The book is an American demonology. And, Colin, when you wrote this, what were you trying to actually do? I mean, is it just a theory, an overall philosophy that you wanted to get out? Or tell me a little bit about the background of this book.
Well, I've always been interested in what quite a few people call secret histories. If you look at the broad stream of history, you know there's something else behind it. You have to dig out the books that matter. And I'd written the book on George Adamski, and then I came across Ruppelt's book, Captain Ruppelt's book, called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. First, a bit about Ruppelt himself. He was a B-29 navigator during the Second World War, and he was based at Tinian, in the Pacific, the big B-29 base, from which Enola Gay and Boxcar took off to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I mentioned in the book that if there'd been an accident or illness or something, Ruppelt, as a group navigator, might well have been in one of those aircraft as a replacement. So you've got a much decorated Air Force officer, and he left the Air Force in 45, demobbed, as we call it over here, and joined Northrop. Now, Northrop, the firm, Northrop was...
Yeah, the aircraft...
Leading aircraft companies, developing, for instance, the flying wing, and which, for some peculiar reason, was abandoned in favor of the B-36, which is a very bad move, but that's by the way. And Ruppelt took his engineering degree at Northrop. Then along came the Korean War, which, of course, saw Ruppelt as a reserve captain called up, and he was a bit over the hill for flying. Age-wise, and he went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to join Air Technical Intelligence Command. There, we're talking about 52 now, there he was given the job initially of examining the MiG-15, the Russian fighter, which was causing the Sabre.
Yeah, it was actually flying circles around the Sabre.
It was flying circles.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The Sabre... Only, if you had a really good pilot, the Sabre could match it, but if you didn't, it was trouble. And they wanted to know all about the MiG-15. They were taking two MiG-15s apart at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base there, and trying to improve the Sabre, etc. He was put in charge of analysis of the MiG-15. He was at his desk one day doing this job when he heard laughter from another desk across the way. On inquiring what the laughter was about, he was told that these people were investigating flying saucers. And this is Ruppelt's first experience of the phrase flying saucer. And he saw that the men concerned, who were conscripts as well, were just laughing at the subject and doing nothing about it, yet they were supposed to analyze it. And he mentioned this to his superior, Rosengarten, Colonel Rosengarten. And Rosengarten said, "Well, yeah, why don't you take the job?" And Ruppelt said, "Well, this sounds much more interesting than what I'm doing at the moment." So he took the desk job. It was called Project Blue Book.
Yes.
And he set ufological investigation on a proper scientific basis. He installed punch card systems, and it started at square one. I mean, people were just throwing notes and shooting.
Yeah, it was. In fact, we had Dr. Bruce McAbee talking about his first visit to one of these investigative places, and it was a mess. File cabinets everywhere, and things open, and nothing filed properly. And so these punch card systems back then were the early forerunners of today's computer science.
Yes, Bruce McAtee, he's a friend of mine, wouldn't know this stuff very well, and he's talking about that early period. And Ruppelt put it on a proper base. And Ruppelt thought things were going well, until he found that there was sudden resistance from the Air Force. And here's where the trouble began. Okay, we've got these reports, said Ruppelt. We've got it on the technical intelligence, of which he knew a lot, of course, because that was his life and career, is on a right basis. Let's go, because we've got something in our skies that's most peculiar, because the reports are coming in, and we haven't got enough staff, facilities to analyze and collect these reports. Okay, so when am I going to get reinforced? And of course he wasn't going to get reinforced. The Air Force started putting the brakes on. Now this is when Ruppelt started thinking that there's something very odd about the restrictions placed on my Blue Book investigations. Now this really is the heart of the matter. And he found that he was summoned to his chief was summoned to the conferences at the Pentagon, and reported to Ruppelt that the Pentagon won't accept it. The Pentagon, the war machine, they had the Korean War at the time, mind you.
Yes.
A lot on their plate. One can understand that. And the last thing they wanted was the UFO. So the Air Force's attitude was, look, we don't know about these UFOs. They're not knocking down American military aircraft, and so we're going to put them on side for the moment. Because all we're worried about is the Chinese and the MiG-15, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's leave this damn UFO side, because we don't have the men, the material, or the capacity, or the facilities to analyze this damn thing in the skies. So when people say that it was a conspiracy by the Air Force, it has to be realized what the Air Force had on its hands at the time. You know, they couldn't cope with it.
Yeah, you make a good point there. And you can only do so much every day.
You can only do so much every day, particularly, you know, when there's big things.
And you have to examine threats if you're in a war situation, and our American planes were being knocked down by the Chinese MiGs.
Yes, indeed. And you get, you know, you know your history, Jerry. You know, MacArthur, the commander in chief in Korea, South Korea.
Yeah, he had that going on too.
Yeah, pushing for nuclear attack.
Yeah, right.
On Mao's.
And ultimately, Truman called him home, and then MacArthur made "You don't have the old soldiers to kick around anymore" speech.
Yeah, indeed.
So for people that weren't around during that time, there were a lot of things happening.
Yeah, a lot of things.
And so, it may or may not be a complete cover-up.
I can't cope with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was also a cultural, intellectual element with the ufologists, which the military, of course, being military, bless them. I love the military. I'm not criticizing the military here at all. But the military don't have time for intellectual speculation. They're not the type. Yeah. And there was something very odd about the UFO that the military didn't like at all. Yeah. They're soldiers. They're warriors, for goodness sake. You know, not intellectual.
Well, and plus, there is the political ramifications. These things are here and we can't do anything about it.
That's right. I think you put your finger on it. This is the situation today, in my mind.
Yeah.
They're here, we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, the more I do this, I've been doing these shows for decades now, the more I come to the conclusion that maybe we really don't know all that much. You know, and we just don't want to admit it.
Right.
Yeah, something's here. They're doing something to somebody, and it's pretty horrible, but we don't know what to do about it.
Is that, yeah.
And they're not going to make a speech like that.
Yeah, is that, yes. And so really, they can't do anything about it. On the other hand, there is another stream of thought here that the Roswell business, of course, contradicts what we just concluded. You know, so you have to hold one thread here, another thread at the side of it, and then have a look at it, don't you?
Well, and the British or the American military, the Soviet military, the political apparatus of these countries, they're not monolithic, even though they like to appear to be.
They like to appear to be, yes.
But there are many, many facets. I know when I joined the Army,
yes,
in the 60s, I thought that, you know, I'd be a genius. Well, I was surprised. There were quite a few guys in there were fairly sharp. and that was in another wartime. So basically, their first priority is fighting the war or defending,
yes,
or prosecuting whatever their orders are.
Yes.
And so these pesky UFOs, I can understand that thought.
Yeah. Richard Dolan, American writer.
Yes, know him well.
Yeah, called the UFOs and the Security State. And it's an excellent book. I do recommend it. Richard Dolan, and he analyzes the situation we've been talking about over the past few minutes, how the UFO weaves its way through military shenanigans of all kinds, and they brushed it aside rather like a fly on your face.
It's true, and if anything else is, in my opinion, and you can either back me up or not, it's up to you. After all, we both have opinions. But I think the term unintended consequences weighs heavily on almost every official decision anything happens. In other words, they're always you can come out and make a statement, and the unintended consequences might be something that you just really never thought about.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah, and I do think that gets a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And gets a lot of policy.
Yes. There's also the option, the fear option. If these experiences we've had for 50 years are in any sense true or real, then we're in a cultural crisis which makes nuclear crisis look rather small. We're in the position of a loincloth cargo cult native who hasn't invented the wheel meeting.
So, yeah, I get what you're saying. You chose this title, American Demiology, for a reason. I assume it's kind of a double meaning.
Well,
in other words, there's a little demonology there, but maybe it's more than one level.
All cultures have a demonology.
Mm-hmm.
This is a kind of a set of elemental fears embedded in their system. And the demonology comes from America's the great product society, the great consumer society, and it assumes that this consumer society, this technological bent, this almost science fiction genius of America is going to go on and on and on. All of a sudden it comes against this conceptual barrier, even though I use the cliche, we are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there's a sense of shock comes in. This from a, as if, you know, this was a kind of, you've met some kind of demon who's going to, this is a new reality. The demonology is a new reality in which, you know, the old equations, the old paradigms, the old truths are not going to be the same. You got up in the morning, the world was different, you know, and that causes trauma of a certain kind in cultures.
Yeah, in certain areas it certainly does, and with certain people. Sometimes, I'm one of these guys that loves change, challenge, complete reversal of stories, but I didn't realize it until a few years ago that I'm not necessarily the norm. You know what I mean? In other words, most people like to have their life like a comfortable old shoe.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
I never thought of it that way. I thought about, hey, what can I dig up today?
You're unique. See, you're a chosen person.
Well, I don't know who there's some question about who chose who, but anyway.
You're still asking questions. You will never stop asking questions.
And I am amazed sometimes that I ask questions when I think are comparatively innocent that people get offended and get pushed out of shape about and think you're trying to prove some point, and actually all you're doing is asking the question.
Yeah, you're making them think on programs like this. This is the new machine for making people think.
You obviously, when you wrote this book, you wanted people to think.
Yeah.
What do you want them to think, Colin?
That's the kind of book I write. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
To look at themselves, you know, and to look at the external world and say, I don't see it in traditional terms. I see it in terms of a new paradigm emerging here, and the UFO is part of a new paradigm, whether we like it or not. Even the skeptics agree on that. You know, and there are many skeptics who say that the UFOs don't exist. They're fantasies. They're consumer fantasies. This is called the psychosocial theory of the UFO appearance.
Yeah, sure.
I've had a UFO experience myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 25 years ago. Yeah, and believe me.
Was it a contact or a sighting or what?
No creatures involved, no orthons or humanoid beings involved.
Where did that happen, in England?
Yeah, it happened outside my house, yeah. And
did they speak to you?
No, there were no beings.
Okay, I understand. But you saw...
People have, but I didn't, no.
Yeah.
I was coming back and home, and I had this iron fence to my right, and I saw a blinding light in the sky, which went right to the back of my head, believe me. I'm that kind of person. I haven't had an experience like this since. So, and I looked at this light. It was like one of those disco lights, you know, big in the sky. It went right to the back of my head. I thought, what's happening to me? And I shouted down to the basement, to where my girlfriend lived at the time. I said, Karen, come and have a look at this. Come and have a look at this. Quickly now. She came, started mounting the steps from the basement to the road level. And I thought to myself, if she doesn't see what I'm seeing, then I'll have to go to the doctor. Or
Right, you're hallucinating.
Give me some drugs.
Right.
Because I don't take drugs and I don't drink. And
did she see it?
To the top of the steps and saw this light. And I never forget her face as the light struck across her face. We then saw the most fantastic thing I've ever seen in my life. I saw the shape of a Lancaster bomber, you know, of World War II, blacked out, stationary, pointing north over the square in front of the house, as if it were suspended on a kind of war memorial. Black shape. Its propellers were not moving. This shape, this aircraft, then changed its shape, morphed, we would call it today, I suppose.
Yes.
And it flew off, it came a triangle. I know this sounds utterly fantastic, your listeners will think, you know, we've got a madman. I'm telling you listeners that...
Well, that's one of the problems when you relate these stories.
I saw this thing, and I don't take drugs, you know, I have no medical or psychological problems, and I don't...
Yeah, but you know, after 25 years and lots of reports, we see these ship-shaping things.
Yeah, yeah. But then they didn't talk about shape-shifting so much. I have not heard of it in ufology. It's a late thing, that is. And so we didn't speak. And then we saw another, after the thing had disappeared, we saw another light, a smaller light. And from this smaller light came about 8 cycles of a sine wave, you know, the wavy line, yeah? And, understand, she was a rather physics graduate, the ideal witness. And, silent and shocked, we went down to the basement where she lived. And there, on her settee, was, believe it or not, a guy in black. Yeah, a man in black. And he was explained at first. He said, I'm just asking Karen if I could stay here for a few minutes because of a friend of the guy upstairs. And she said yes. And so he went away. And I've never known this woman let in a stranger at night. I said, how did you let this guy in? Because she wasn't the kind of woman who let anybody in.
Right.
She said, I don't really know. He came to the door and I let him in. I said, ah, what? Most unusual behavior. And then I saw Alan, the guy upstairs, and I said, we saw the next day. And I said, I saw your friend last night. He was waiting for you, but he didn't wait in the final analysis. And what was he like? I said, he had blonde hair, suit, very well dressed, very well spoken. And he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the friend that joined it, tried to join him from there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have a friend like that. I don't have a friend like that. And my spine chilled again. Yeah. He said, I don't have a friend like that.
Mm-hmm.
God knows who the guy was. I just jumped one incident.
Now, that brings me where, you know, our time's almost up. That brings me to this article in Phenomena Magazine, Managing Mysteries.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what that's about. I mean, how did you manage this mystery? I guess you just filed it away.
How did we finish it? Yeah, you have to learn to live with it. And it's something, you know, that you can't explain, you never will explain. I mean, you're the kind of person who has his experiences every day. I mean, not a load of nonsense, forget it, you know. I've never seen anything like it before, and I've never seen anything like it since. And it's with me. I still see Karen occasionally, and that's all we talk about, you know, what happened that night. I will add that a central feature of the story is that I've just jumped a feature of the story. I went back to my own flat, and I fed my cats after we'd seen this thing. And I opened the tin, I put the cat food in the dishes on the floor, And believe it or not, Jerry, when I straightened up with the cat food in my hand, I knew I'd lost time.
Really?
Yeah, I knew I'd lost time.
Hmm.
And I realized I'd lost about 20 minutes. I'd been to see a film, and I phoned the manager immediately. It was about 11:30 at night. I thought, I can catch him before he goes. And I just caught him before he went away. And he confirmed the time that the cinema film, the show, went down. And I realized, I said, thank you very much. I didn't tell him this.
So you did have missing time?
I did have missing time. I did have missing time, I swear to you, yes.
So how do we manage these mysteries?
How do we manage the mysteries? Well, from that time, I mean, I lived a normal, healthy life. It didn't affect me
okay. In
any way, in any physical way. I'm quite strong. And it did, however, affect the relationship between myself and her. Yeah.
In other words, you have since moved on in your personal life.
Yes.
And she has too, but not together.
Not together, right.
It was, well, my experience, Colin, is that from, you know, all these shows I've done over the years, and I'm by far not a researcher of note of anything. I just basically talk to people and listen.
Yes.
And let the radio audience in on it too.
Yes.
UFO sightings and experiences are all life-changing.
They are, yes. They change that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's life-changing in the sense that, you know, I wanted to write, I got grabbed books by Adamski and Rufels and so on.
Sure.
And it started me there. I thought, well, this is a genuine experience. These things are genuine. They're part of our and first of all, the rationalizations that come into your head, you know, is it the Air Force on maneuvers, for God's sake? Because if it is, I'm going to complain, you know, rationalize it. Like, is this a new Air Force weapon? Are they messing around with us? And they weren't. This wasn't an Air Force weapon. They weren't messing around with us, you know, to do such things over central
yep.
London, I'm talking.
Yeah, my belief is there probably are black projects, but most of these things we talk about aren't.
Yeah.
I mean, we never use them. So it seems to be a terrible waste of money if it's ours.
Yeah. We still send men with bayonets into wars.
Right. Colin, we're almost out of time. You got anything you want to bring out here before we wrap the show up?
No, I think that...
Other than buy the book?
Buy the book. It's a really interesting read. It will change your life. For very little cost.
Okay, for an Englishman, you do a good commercial.
Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it. We'll talk again.
Well, thank you very much indeed.